It's time for KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. This week, a wide-ranging conversation on the state of education in the San Diego region. What new standardized test results have to say about student performance 5 years on from the pandemic.
What we've long seen in education is that socioeconomics plays a massive role.
We take a look at what's been working in schools today and how schools are looking to expand their impact beyond the classroom. That's all ahead on the Roundtable. The nation's report card is out, and while standardized tests may not tell us the whole story, they can give us a glimpse into how the nation's students are faring. So what do these results tell us about how San Diego's kids and schools are doing today? To talk more about it, I'm here with Katie Anastas. She is KPBS's education reporter. Hey, Katie.
Hi.
And I'm also here with Jacob McWinney. He is the education reporter at The Voice of San Diego. What's up, Jacob?
Nothing much. How's it going, Andrew?
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. Katie, this is your inaugural time on Roundtable, so
thanks for
being here. Welcome. Jacob is more of a vet. He's back again with us. So let's get into it. You know, one of my, and I'm sure my kids' favorite subjects, tests. I'm wondering if you can each give us a short headline of what these results show us about how students are doing today. Katie?
I'd say for San Diego Unified, my headline would be, reading is fine, math is getting better, but income is still a factor.
Jacob?
I think that's a really important thing to consider, right, this income metric here. I would say something similar, which is that San Diego Unified is doing comparatively better than some other areas, but that's only because those other areas are doing pretty poorly. And so while there is some reason for optimism in San Diego Unified, that is you got to hedge that optimism quite a bit.
So I want to get more into that kind of economic question and some of the other stuff you're kind of hinting at here. But Jacob, can you first kind of explain more what this so-called Nation's Report Card actually is and what it consists of?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Nation's Report Card is kind of shorthand for the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP test, as it's often referred to. And it is a standardized test that's administered to select districts across the nation. And it's administered to both fourth and eighth graders, and they test reading and math. And, you know, it's administered every 2 years. And long story short is that students nationally are doing pretty poorly. Reading scores dropped, you know, with the scores of eighth graders reaching the lowest point in the assessment's history. So that's really bad news. When it comes to math, eighth grader scores kind of stayed where they were nationally. Really, the only bright spot that we have is the scores of fourth graders in math increased just the tiniest little bit. And it's also important to remember that post-COVID, we were already dealing with a significant drop, right? So what educators and anyone who really cares about students and education were hoping to see were signs of recovery, but what they got didn't really look like that.
So, Katie, it sounds like there's kind of, I don't know, a mixed bag there nationally. I mean, what jumps out to you about the numbers for San Diego specifically?
San Diego also kind of has a mixed bag. I think reading for eighth graders and fourth graders both kind of stayed the same compared to 2022. Math did improve a little bit for fourth graders, which is exciting because those were the kids who were in kindergarten when the pandemic started. So I think everybody's been closely awaiting kind of how those kids are doing right now. So I think any improvement among fourth graders is a bright spot. And we saw that a little bit in math.
Yeah, that's absolutely something to consider, which is, you know, exactly how old these kids were when the pandemic hit. And those fourth graders are, you know, the ones who were the youngest during that pandemic and trying to figure out exactly all of the educational basics that they'll need for the rest of their journey. So it is encouraging to see that.
That's, yeah. So, you know, Katie, you'd mentioned kind of the challenges of economically disadvantaged students and some of the challenges that come out from these, you know, test results. Could you talk more about that?
Sure. So, you know, one thing that stood out to me from these results is that San Diego Unified started participating in this test back in 2003. Different districts have kind of joined in at different times, but you can compare the 2024 scores to the 2023 scores. And one thing that's getting worse is the gap between economically disadvantaged students and those who are not economically disadvantaged. And that's grown since 2003. So it's helpful because the National Assessment of Educational Progress puts out kind of examples of what proficiency means. So thinking about fourth grade math, if you're proficient, you understand things like factors and multiples, and you can solve one-step equations. And I think those are helpful things to keep in mind. But looking at the economic information, fourth graders who were economically disadvantaged had lower scores than their peers. And for those students, 3 in 10 scored proficient in math. So they know their factors, know their multiples. That's compared to 7 in 10 who are not economically disadvantaged. So there's still that big difference.
Pretty big difference there.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. Jacob, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, those results, while really disappointing, are not really all that surprising. What we've long seen in education is that socioeconomics plays a massive role, right? So if you see – if you show me, you know, a school's standardized test scores, I can with a fair degree of accuracy tell you, you know, what the level of poverty looks like in the community. As poverty rises, test scores fall. As poverty falls, test scores rise. And so this achievement gap that Katie's describing has been around for a long time. It's something that's plagued education, and it's something that educational leaders still don't know how to solve, even though they've been trying.
So I think around, you know, this conversation around San Diego schools, a lot of times it seems like we're talking about San Diego Unified solely. But the fact is there's some, what, 40 other local school districts, right? So how do you judge how they did in these tests and how they're doing compared to the San Diego Unified data we have here?
So the NAEP scores, right? They only judge select districts. San Diego Unified being one of the large urban districts, you know, in the country, they take part in the NAEP scores. The only real metric that we have to judge how, let's say, Lakeside Elementary School District and San Diego Unified, how they compare are statewide test scores. And statewide test scores really back up what we've seen at the national level. There were big drops after the pandemic. And while districts like San Diego Unified have slowly started to claw their way back up, they still haven't kind of regained the big losses that we saw. And like I mentioned with socioeconomics, when you look at a Cajon Valley school district, you know, which is a district with a high level of poverty, and you look at a San Dieguito, those districts perform very differently. And as you would expect, San Dieguito does a lot better than Cajon Valley. And a lot of this, again, boils down to socioeconomics.
And Katie, you've done some reporting on some of these more rural school districts and some of the particular challenges they face that maybe, you know, San Diego Unified with its, you know, larger size may not. How do you see that playing out in school performance in the student assessments?
Well, I've focused on in that reporting focused on kind of capital improvements and construction, and we saw in the last election a lot of districts across the county had bond measures on the ballot, and I think about half of them passed and about half of them didn't. And as we heard throughout the election, kind of household income and your day-to-day bills played a big role in how you voted this year. And that was true for bond measures too. So wealthier districts are much more likely to pass a bond because those are households that feel like they can handle a slight tax increase. In lower income districts, those families don't feel like they can take that tax increase, and so they vote against it. And I visited Ramona Unified, for example, and talked to folks in the San Ysidro school district. And in both of those districts, you know, they have too small of a staff to spend the time that it takes oftentimes to apply for state funding and get in line for state grants and have what takes the work of a full-time staffer and add that to the plate of somebody who has, you know, five other roles in these districts.
And then on the flip side, Jacob, we have San Diego Unified, which you could argue is, you know, so much infinitesimally like more larger than these smaller ones. How does that impact, you know, how they approach their approach to education?
It impacts it a lot, right? So San Diego Unified, we think about it, second largest district in California, 100,000-ish students. It's been dropping for a long time. But that size means that you can essentially operate these economies of scale, right? So when you look at a San Diego Unified budget and you think about administration, there is less of a percentage of their budget being spent on administration than, say, a DEHISA, right, which has just a couple of schools and inevitably has to have more, a higher percentage of their staff be administration. That can help out for districts like San Diego Unified. It also means that they have people who whose whole job is basically to, you know, liaise with the state and try to increase funding and try to get their legislative priorities passed. So it can make a big difference to have these big districts. And there has long been a conversation of whether San Diego Unified is too big, whether these small districts are too small. You know, I can't really comment on exactly how these should be put together, but I do think that research shows that a district of a certain size, of a certain larger size, tends to deliver better results than super tiny districts, unless that super tiny district is in an area that's very, very wealthy and gets a lot of funds from property taxes.
So, Katie, before joining us here at KPBS, you were reporting in Alaska on education issues there. What jumps out to you that's different or maybe the same about what you see here in San Diego schools?
I think that speaking of kind of rural versus urban districts or smaller districts versus large districts, in Alaska, the smaller districts are often really geographically isolated. My first job was at a station on an island that has a population of about 2,000 people. And there, you know, you're leaving town to get pretty basic medical treatment. All of your groceries are getting flown in or delivered in on a boat. And I think a similarity is that the cost of living is a huge factor for families, for teachers. It influences where people choose to live. An interesting thing that was going on in Alaska when I was there was that the state was coming up with new statewide standards for reading curriculum. And they were in the process of rolling out new rules of, you know, when do you have to decide whether to hold a student back for another year? And how are you going to communicate that to parents? And how are you going to fund this mandate that's being put out to students? So I think all schools in Alaska are very in tune with what's happening at the state government level. And I think that's something I want to bring to my reporting here is like keeping an eye on how are legislative decisions at the state level playing out at the local level, because that's huge in Alaska.
After the break, we continue our conversation about the state of education in San Diego and beyond and take a look at what's working in schools today. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. Welcome back to Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. I'm here with Katie Anastas from KPBS, along with Jacob McWinney from Voice of San Diego. And today on the show, we've been talking about how San Diego school kids are doing 5 years on from pandemic school closures. So now I want to kind of take us back a little bit. We've been kind of talking about these results today, but you know, this has come up a couple of times in our conversation, just reference to the COVID pandemic and just really, you know, the signpost it's become for education, right? I think when, you know, seeing these test results, it's often, you know, student performance now versus pre-pandemic levels. I see that kind of reference a lot. And we're reaching this sort of 5-year mark of when schools were closed, when the pandemic took hold and really kind of turned, you know, education upside down. And I'm curious, you know, I wanted to kind of throw this to each of you. What do we know now about the pandemic's long-term impacts on kids in schools? Jacob?
Well, I think the big headline is that it really screwed kids up on a whole bunch of levels. I think that social emotional learning really, really took a hit. And then you look at a whole bunch of educational indicators, whether you want to look at test scores. But for me, one of the primary things that I've been worrying about a lot over the past couple of years is chronic absenteeism. If anybody's read my work, if anybody's heard me on Roundtable or KPBS before, I'm often droning on about chronic absenteeism because it is one of the most impactful things that happened over the pandemic.
And it's been one of the sort of top priorities of school districts over the last, what, 2-3 years?
Yeah, absolutely, for a lot of reasons, right? One of those is that chronic absenteeism, which is when a kid misses at least 10% of days in the school year, is a leading indicator of how well they're going to do in school. It's an indicator of whether they're going to drop out. It's even an indicator by those dropout rates of whether or not they're going to have to deal with infractions in the law later in life, right? And in addition to that, schools are funded based on attendance. And so schools are really motivated by that bottom line to make sure that kids are showing up in school. And when we talk about chronic absenteeism, the big, big trend that we saw was from the year before the pandemic to the year after kids got back into school. We saw what was essentially a tripling of chronic absenteeism, which is not a good sign, right? And so when we have the socioeconomic conversation, we saw this in chronic absenteeism as well, right? So even though all schools tended to see their rates of chronic absenteeism triple, what that tripling looked like was very different because schools started at very different places. The example I always use is Bird Rock Elementary and Rodriguez Elementary. Bird Rock in kind of the PB La Jolla area and Rodriguez in kind of the Barrio Logan area. Both of those schools saw their rates of chronic absenteeism triple. But Rodriguez started at 25% chronic absenteeism and Bird Rock started at 3% chronic absenteism.
So coming from very different
very different places. And so despite the fact that they tripled, after that tripling, Rodriguez ended up at 75, 76% of their kids were chronically absent and Bird Rock ended at around 12%. And that's a really, really difficult thing to try to figure out. Especially because why kids are chronically absent can be really, really, really different. And when you look at these socioeconomic factors, it makes a lot of sense, right? Maybe a parent has to work two jobs, can't give their kid a ride to school. Maybe they don't have a car. Maybe a kid has to stay home and watch their younger sibling. So figuring out how schools can get involved and actually make an impact and make a dent on how much school kids are missing has been really difficult. But as you said, both schools and the San Diego County Office of Education worked really, really hard to try to make sure that kids are in school, whether they, instituted things like home visits. There were a lot of these things called nudge letters that went out that were letters sent to the homes of parents of families whose kids were chronically absent, trying to explain first what chronic absenteeism is, because there's so much jargon in education that's not a phrase that most parents understand, but also the impact of chronic absenteeism and that their kid was either chronically absent themselves or in danger of falling into it. And these kinds of strategies showed that some success.
And earlier you had referred to, you had mentioned San Diego Unified has seen enrollment drops, over the past couple of years. I mean, are those related or is that other factors altogether in your view?
I think those are other factors pretty much altogether. What San Diego Unified did and will probably see from chronic absenteeism is funding drops because, again, so tied much of funding is tied to that. The good news is that all that hard work that schools did, it's starting to make a difference, right? So countywide, we saw chronic absenteeism jump from like 10% to 30%. It's now been brought down to about 20%, which, again, is an improvement, but it's still twice as bad as it was before the pandemic. And so figuring out not only how to fix this in the present, but also in the future when funding sources are less, bountiful than they were during the pandemic and directly afterwards, that's going to be a big challenge that schools are going to be stuck trying to figure out for years.
And, when I think about, the pandemic and the impact it's had on schools, technology is a big piece of it. As we know, as schools closed, we went to kind of the virtual classroom. How is that still present in kids' lives today, Katie?
Well, I recently went to Horton Elementary School to talk to students and teachers after these scores came out. And I spoke to one fourth grader and I said, "Do you remember how you felt when you got to school in person for the first time? Like, what was that switch like for you? And she said, it was really nice because I could actually focus and I wasn't looking at my screen all day. And this was coming from a fourth grader. Like, she had this awareness of my attention is better when I don't have to look at a screen all day. And that really stood out to me, that kind of awareness of that change within herself and her own attention span. I spoke to her teacher, Winnie Gonzalez, and I asked her, you know, what changes did you see when students came back? And this is what she had to say.
A lot of them were used to being at home, you know, resting when they wanted to rest, eating when they wanted to eat. And even though, you know, they had instruction to be on their laptop a certain time and all of that, a lot of them had to be caregivers for their other family members. And so they, you know, they learned to not be as attentive.
That touches on the socioeconomic piece of this. You know, if you're a kid that has a parent still going to work who can't work from home because their job doesn't allow it, you're going to be at home taking care of your little sibling and maybe making it over to your laptop when you can, but sometimes that's low on your priority list. And so I think watching kids go back to school, have these kind of in-person learning experiences, at least from Winnie Gonzalez, sounds like it's been really good. She said she's been encouraging her students to go pick up hardcover and paperback books, and she's slowly getting them to pick up a real book and not just read something on the screen. And she said it's slowly working and making kids want to read a little bit more. I think it's always funny when you hear a kid put something so plainly, kind of a thing we know about ourselves as adults too. Like, I can focus better if I'm not looking at a screen all day. And so in some cases, kids are starting to seek out kind of that more traditional learning experience after so many years kind of stuck with a screen as their only option.
Well, and also, Jacob, it sounds like, I mean, you know, hearing that reaction, it does make me question how valuable maybe learning to read on a screen is versus, you know, in real life, right? And we've seen, I mean, earlier you mentioned the national test scores. We did see some drops in reading, is that fair to say, you know?
I mean, can you even imagine being a first grader and trying to learn to read when your teacher is on a screen? Can you imagine being a teacher and trying to teach a first grader how to read over Zoom? I mean, it's mind-boggling, right? And it underscores a lot of what we've seen. I mean, even so, one of the things about chronic absenteeism that we see, there is a lot of this picture that are physical problems, right? Transportation issues, logistical issues like that. But one of the things that researchers have started to land on, given how kind of sluggish of a recovery chronic absenteeism has seen, is that families and kids' relationships to schools may just be different than it used to be before the pandemic, right? I think a lot of parents view school as more optional. They're more willing to keep their kid home if they're sick. They're more willing to listen to their kid if their kid says, can you call me out? Can we do this and that, you know? And so figuring out exactly how to repair that relationship is going to take a lot of time. And I think it's going to take a lot of careful work, underscoring just how difficult the online teaching experience is. I did some reporting last year about virtual schools. And the headline for that of that story literally was just virtual school isn't working. Because we see very, very, very clearly through performance data that virtual options tend to leave kids with worse test scores than any other option, particularly fully virtual options and particularly fully virtual charter schools. By far, kids succeed at a much, much worse rate in those schools. And so while sure it may work for some kids and sure, maybe some kids might prefer that, it should be a last resort option because kids learn better when they're in school. They learn better when their teacher is there, and they learn better when they're part of a learning community as opposed to isolated at home. So if there's something that we take from the pandemic, I really hope part of it at least is the power of in-person learning.
I have to, you know, in full disclosure, just say, Jacob, you know, I can't imagine what it was like to be a first grader on screen, but I can imagine what it was like to be the parent of a first grader on screen in 2020.
Well, give us that perspective. What did it seem like?
Impossible.
I rest my case. Yeah.
Our education roundtable continues after the break. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. Welcome back to Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Today we're talking about the state of education in the San Diego region as new nationwide test results. Tell us a bit more about where students are right now. I'm speaking with KPBS education reporter Katie Anastas, along with Voice of San Diego's Jacob McWinney. So we've talked a little bit about what we're seeing with the test results today, as well as took a look back at the pandemic and some of the learnings there. Now I kind of want to look a little bit to what's coming next. Katie, I'm going to start with you. You know, you're fairly new to this education beat here in San Diego. What kind of stories, what kind of areas are you looking to explore on the education beat here?
I think that the recent test scores have actually given me some ideas of areas I want to cover. One, of course, is, you know, how Latino students are faring right now. Their scores have long been lower than white students, and that's been the case, at least for the NAEP scores. It's been the case since the district first started participating. So I'm really interested in particularly dual language immersion programs and especially students who move back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico, how those dual language programs are helping them with both English and Spanish. And I think I'm interested to see kind of how reading curriculum varies at a dual language program to see kind of, are they getting the same approach to reading in the two languages? And are there skills in the way that both of those are taught that can kind of lend themselves to English scores? Another thing that interested me from these recent scores is the difference between boys and girls scores. Boys had slightly higher math scores, at least in eighth grade, and girls had slightly higher reading scores. And I'm really interested in learning, I think, thinking about, you know, absenteeism during the pandemic and thinking about which kids were caregivers of little siblings during the pandemic, it would make sense that those are likely the girls. And I wonder then, why are they still doing better at reading than their male peers?
Yeah, so kind of breaking down some of those differences and what may be underlying them. Like, as you kind of mentioned, I mean, we're talking about schools, but it kind of filters through all these different issues, right? Jacob, you know, you've been doing some reporting on some schools that have actually been doing pretty well in the wake of, you know, these pandemic challenges that you've kind of been talking about here. Tell us more about these, you know, these success stories in San Diego schools.
Yeah. So for everyone that doesn't know, every year Voice of San Diego puts out what we call a Parents Guide to San Diego Schools. The guide kind of walks parents through a whole bunch of need-to-know stuff, right? This year we have a piece about everything you need to know about after-school care, kind of how to get involved at schools. And as part of this, we collect a whole lot of data and break that down into things that, again, parents need to know. And every year we're trying to figure out new ways, new things that we can add. And this year, along with our data partners at UC San Diego's Extended Studies Center for Research and Evaluation, we created a COVID recovery metric. And this basically measured, A, whether a school was impacted by COVID, and B, whether it, if it was impacted, if it's recovered, and C, if it was impacted, if whether it – if a school was impacted by COVID, B, if it was impacted, did it recover? And C, if it was impacted, did it not recover? And so I kind of got inspired by that metric and did a little bit of a pivot and tried to figure out how many schools had more kids meeting state math standards and English standards than before the pandemic. The list was very short, actually. Of the around 700 schools in San Diego County, only 96 of them had more students meeting state standards in English and math. So it's about 13%. And there were a lot of similarities in terms of what they were focusing on. Extended learning opportunities, whether that be before or after school, high dosage tutoring, a reliance on data to kind of inform what kind of interventions kids need. Interestingly enough, one of the schools that had improved the most was a school called Dual Language Immersion North County. Mm. And one of the principals told me exactly what you just said, that after the pandemic, they started figuring out ways that, they started figuring out strategies to tie in learning English with learning Spanish. And they found that this really helped them teach kids both of these languages. So I certainly think there are lots of places that you can explore that. But overall, given just how few of these schools are doing better, after the pandemic than before, I think it really kind of begs the question of if what we're looking at even should be understood as a recovery. Ultimately, I think, and speaking to USC education professor Morgan Polakoff, he kind of dropped this nugget on me that kind of blew my mind, which is it might not really be all that helpful to think of what schools are working on right now as recovery. Instead, maybe we should just understand this post-pandemic period as a brand new benchmark, and that schools are continuing to work to improve from this point, instead of trying to force them to claw back everything they've lost in that pandemic period.
So really, just treating it like it's a whole new sort of era,
new
of
slate.
Schools. Yeah. Wow. One potential challenge that it's coming with is it's coming in a very different fiscal environment, right? Like budgets are much different than they were during the pandemic when they had a lot of federal pandemic aid. How is that going to shape the conversations around schools and the directions they want to go in the coming years?
I think the conversations in the coming years are oftentimes going to be dominated by this budget picture, right? As you said, while there may have been educational chaos in schools, the federal government was dumping billions into them, right? San Diego Unified got hundreds of millions in federal aid. And now that those federal aid dollars have dried up, what they're facing is really a budget wake-up call. Last year they faced a massive budget shortfall. This year they're facing an even bigger budget shortfall. At one point it was $176 million. They've since found some places to cut, right? And so they've brought it down to about $110 million or so. But when you look at that, that's $110 million shortfall in a total budget of $1.1 billion. So this is not small potatoes we're talking about, right? Big changes need to happen to kind of prevent this shortfall from rolling over year after year and turning into this massive systemic deficit that really could change how we understand schools. I've spoken to school board leaders like Cody Patterson. He's the current board president, and he's insisted that district leaders are not going to be willing to accept small cuts, and that they really are going to try to, head off this deficit by making the big, difficult decisions that need to happen. I think the jury is still out on whether or not they will do that, especially given their history. Part of the reason that the district is in this position is because of decisions they've made, right? Just last year, even as leaders were projecting these big deficits, the board approved $517 million in teacher raises. That's about a 15% pay increase for teachers. That also is not small potatoes. And while teachers' jobs are extremely hard, and I don't think anybody would say that we think teachers should be paid less, decisions like that pay increase played a significant role in where we're at right now and exacerbated the budget crisis. And so those decisions that board members are going to be facing are all the more important. Luckily for them, California is not facing the kind of deficit that it did in past years. And Governor Gavin Newsom's latest budget proposal doesn't cut school funding, but it also doesn't do them any favors by increasing school funding, right? So San Diego Unified leaders are going to be on their own trying to figure out exactly how to square this budget deficit.
And around all that, Katie, you recently did a story reporting on how San Diego schools are facing a problem with not having enough special education teachers. And it sounds like they're just simply overwhelmed, right? They have too many, their caseloads are way too high, right?
That's right. The contract between the teachers union and the district sets a limit of the number of students that each education specialist can have kind of in their caseload. And it depends on kind of the needs of the students, what that limit looks like. But across the district, there are education specialists that have, you know, for example, if their cap is 20, I spoke to a teacher who's had a caseload of 35 students last year. And that's across, you know, if you picture an elementary school, that's going from kindergarten to fifth grade. You're juggling in your mind all of the needs of these kids, going into general education classrooms, sitting with those kids, offering them support, meeting with parents, talking with them about their needs at school and at home. And doing that with 20 students, I would imagine, would be difficult. Adding 15 more just seems unimaginable. And I think in some cases is making people leave the district, which is, of course, the worst case scenario. A lot of the teachers I spoke to made the argument that it's hard to recruit new teachers when the assessment from the current staff is this is really, really difficult. And the district, for its part, is setting up kind of a partnership with local universities to try to recruit special education teachers that way. In the past, they've helped teachers get their special education credential so that they can take those jobs if they open up in the district and want to. So they're looking for ways to kind of build up their teaching staff in special education. But ultimately, you know, day to day, there are a lot of teachers out there in the district right now that are just overwhelmed.
Do we have a clear understanding of what's behind the shortage? I mean, we've been talking about the impact of the pandemic, and we've heard a lot about, you know, the mental health impacts and how that's had on kids. I mean, is that playing out here in some of the educational needs of San Diego's kids?
I think certainly. What we have seen is percentage of kids who qualify and need special education services has risen for years and years. But also, these are really hard jobs, as Katie said. They require a lot of time. They require a lot of effort. And they're very emotionally heavy. In addition to that, they require additional certifications that not all teachers have. And teachers generally are just underpaid compared to other folks who have similar degrees and similar training. And so coming into this field is not super tempting for a lot of folks, right? Not a lot of people look at this reality and say, hey, I want to get paid comparatively less and I want to do a whole lot of very hard emotional work. So these shortages, they exist across the state. They exist across the country, and it's particularly in special education. And I think a lot of it is because that work is really damn hard and teachers don't get paid a whole lot to do it.
Another trend that has been growing in San Diego schools that I know both of you have reported on, the way I'm looking at it is sort of schools' role in society increasing, right? Not just teaching K through 12 kids, but being more involved in people's lives and some of the problems that we face in our community. I'm wondering, Jacob, can you talk a little bit about how that's playing out in our region today?
Yeah. So, you know, schools have long had this kind of impossible task, right? Society creates inequality, and then kids go into a classroom and schools are told, now make these kids have an equal education. That's impossible, right? A kid goes in, maybe they haven't slept well because they're sleeping on grandma's couch, or maybe they're hungry because they haven't eaten. Inevitably, they will have different results than a kid whose parents can afford a tutor, for example. And so these kinds of wraparound services that schools are starting to turn to are an effort to kind of, bring more equality to education. So one of those examples is community schools. Those are schools that do provide these wraparound services. And each community school is supposed to look very different depending on what the needs of that community they serve are. So sometimes they may have food pantries. Sometimes they may give eye exams. Sometimes they have additional mental health supports. But all of these things are, again, an attempt to kind of equalize education. San Diego Unified has really leaned into community schools, but whether or not they can keep them going will be something we have to see, right? A lot of these were launched with short-term grant funding by the state, and so after 5 years, that grant funding goes away. So whether San Diego Unified will continue to be able to stand those up is yet to be seen. Another example of this kind of increased role of public education is Logan Memorial Educational Campus. San Diego Unified recently opened its first infant care facility there. It's a Montessori center for kids, you know, from just a couple months old up to three and through preschool and then to UTK. That's something the district has never done. It's also something the state doesn't provide funding for. Part of the district's motivation in launching this is just that they think that kids should have access to free, high-quality childcare, especially because, at least to trustee Richard Barrera, childcare tends to be a bit of a lose-lose, right? It's very expensive for parents, and the people who work in that industry don't get paid enough to live. So increasing the access to it could be a win-win. And in order to advocate for stuff like that at the state, you have to have a successful program. So they're viewing this Montessori Center as something that potentially they can then use, if successful, to advocate for this increased funding. It would also help, potentially, with the long-term enrollment issues that schools across the country are dealing with, given that people just are having less kids. If you expand the number of kids who are able to go to public school, then your enrollment isn't looking so dicey.
Oh, interesting. So there's an enrollment piece that's kind of coming up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the enrollment declines. It's not just San Diego Unified or other area school districts kind of facing the same challenges roughly?
Yeah. So post Great Recession, people just kind of turned it down on having kids. And ever since then, we have seen each generation be a little bit smaller than the last. And so what districts are facing is ultimately smaller and smaller classes basically for eternity, right? And so whether or not they start to contract it seems pretty inevitable. And certainly there are outliers, you know, places where families are moving in. Maybe it's less expensive than San Diego, and so they relocate to Riverside or whatever.
Right.
But the basic challenge is, how do we keep enrollment up when there are just less kids to go around?
Katie, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, so this is making me think of a point that got brought up in a budget meeting for San Diego Unified this week, and they were looking at the projected enrollment numbers for next year, and they're still going down. And yet there will likely be more students in Universal TK because the age range of students that qualify for that is set to expand. So that just speaks to the point of, you can expand who qualifies as an enrolled student, and even then the numbers continue to go down.
Wow. Even, yeah, you add a new grade and it still doesn't help with the numbers. Wow. That's pretty stark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, over the past couple of years, the expansion of UTK was pretty much the only reason why San Diego Unified didn't see larger drops in enrollment. It's blunted some of that enrollment decline, but it's not erased it.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of budget questions, and that's not even really kind of getting into what's happening in Washington. I mean, there are rumors that the Department of Education might not necessarily be around next year, right?
Yeah, so Trump has explicitly promised that he will eliminate the Department of Education. Whether or not he follows through, I think, is an open question. Republicans have long wanted to get rid of the Department of Education. It's actually a fairly new agency that just was created by Carter. And there are just a whole lot of unknowns. One thing I think is important for people to understand is that the vast, vast majority of money that funds schools doesn't come from the federal level in California, right? The feds provide maybe between 10 and 25% of school funding, depending on the year. It shot up to about 25% over the pandemic because all of the federal relief money, but generally it's closer to that 10%. And so even if the Department of Education is eliminated, that money is likely to be dispersed by other agencies. So public schools, it's not likely that they will lose all that money. It's certainly possible, but it's not likely. What I've been concerned with, though, is one of the kind of knock-on effects of the elimination of Department of Education. Because the Department of Education isn't just about money. It also performs important, like, oversight functions, right? Some of which have already been targeted by Trump, like protections for trans and LGBTQ plus students. Take federal Title IX laws, right, which protect students from discrimination. Just last year, the Department of Ed's Office for Civil Rights, which investigates these Title IX claims, released a damning report about San Diego Unified's years-long failure to respond to sexual harassment complaints. That report was vital because it kind of laid bare all of the ways in which the district systems had fallen short, and it required this laundry list of improvements that the district pledged to make. If the Department of Ed were eliminated, investigations like that would go away. The Office for Civil Rights would go bye-bye, right? Leaving the world of school misconduct even murkier than before, which is not good news because the world of sexual misconduct in schools is already quite murky. And so while I think Trump's goal with all of this is to eliminate what he views as, you know, evil woke DEI stuff, what could end up happening is important oversights that are meant to protect the most vulnerable of students could go away and leave students even more vulnerable.
We're going to have to leave it there. We started talking about tests, but clearly it's so much more going on with, you know, schools and students. I just want to thank both of you for being here and kind of like taking the time to kind of dig into this, because I know as a parent myself, sometimes, you know, you see a headline here or there and you don't know kind of where things are. So we really appreciate you breaking this down. I've been speaking with KPBS education reporter Katie Anastas, along with Jacob McWinney, who's the education reporter with The Voice of San Diego. He also does some cool local music reviews. You should check it out. But thank you both for being here. And we got to do this again. Thanks.
Anytime.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andrew.
That'll do it for Roundtable this week. Thanks so much for being here. If you missed any of the show, you can listen to the entire show anytime as a podcast. Roundtable airs on KPBS-FM at noon on Fridays, again Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show, you can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org. You can also leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producer this week was Brandon Trufa. The show was produced by Ashley Rush. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. I'm Andrew Bracken. Thanks again for listening, and have a great weekend.